So I will talk about this, and it's going to be a mostly incoherent talk, just bringing up some themes dear to my heart, which I encountered in my work on natural algorithms, and there'll be some geometry. So in 1932, there's this English psychologist, Bartlett, who performed the following experiment. So he drew an owl like this, and then he gave it to one of his students, and he said, just look at it for 2 minutes. Did, and then he just yanked the owl out, just hid the drawing from the student, and said to the student, I want you to redraw it from memory. So, and you can take as much time as you want. So he did this, and then he got the owl. Now, that student has just drawn the owl, and what he's going to do is go to his friend, another student, and ask him to do the same thing. So again, make sure we're all on the same page. He's going to show his own owl to his friend for 2 minutes, and then he will ask the friend to redraw it from memory. And then this will keep on iterating, okay? So these are the pictures from 1932, so this is what happened. So you have this, 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 and then you get a cat. And you always get a cat. And now the most interesting thing about this picture is really here, is really here because the tail changes direction. Just think about it. I mean, it means that the concept of a cat has been so internalized that it no longer matters where the tail goes. It's totally part of that thing. So in 1932, they wanted to understand what's happening. And of course, they didn't have the tools to do that. They're psychologists. And they still don't have the tools to do that, so they don't have a clue. But more work has been done on this. And so this is a form of what's called iterated learning. I don't know if this microphone does anything. Is it placebo or is it actually fine? Okay, all right. So there's a teacher who is going to teach something here, an owl, and then provide that samples, so the learner will sample from that owl, and then will come up with its own hypothesis of what they saw and draw it, and then it'll sample to the second learner, and this will go on forever, okay? And so modern psychologists, these are psycholinguists. Psycholinguists is a great term. These are not linguists that happen to be psychos. They're actually linguists that have a psychological angle, although the two are not incompatible. They're interested in languages, and they have a theory of languages that I don't want to get too specific, but roughly speaking, think of a giant vector space of languages, and so your own language is a mixture of some canonical proto-languages that capture all that matters about language. So now you want somebody to teach you Chinese. So she's going to teach you Chinese for 6 months. Equipped with your knowledge of Chinese, you are going to be teaching your friend Chinese for 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah, 6 months. It's a very, very smart, intense people. And then, equipped with that knowledge, you're going to be teaching China. And let's say this takes place in the United States, just so there's one language, English, that everybody speaks, and then you're trying to learn Chinese. So, so what will happen is that after a while, people will be teaching each other English. Chinese will have been entirely expunged from that process. So now in this model of linguistics, the way it works is this, that everybody has a prior. So prior H is a distribution over these canonical languages. And so you draw a language from your own distribution over these canonical languages. So it's a probabilistic mixture. And so when somebody tries to teach you something, then you have your own prior, and then you have the likelihood that given a certain hypothesis that you've drawn as a candidate language, it will output some data when you sample from it. So then on the basis of the data here, you do some Bayesian inverse, and then you get you update your posterior and so on and so forth. Now, Kalish and Griffiths show that this is a form of Gibbs sampling, and so it will mix to the prior, which is another way of saying that if you start teaching Chinese like this, after a while, people will teach each other only the language that they already know, which is rephrasing the notion of mixing. So I got intrigued by this problem, and I'll tell you why later I was intrigued by it. But with a former student of mine, Chu Wang, we showed that actually if you just increase the session length a little bit, so maybe 6 months is the first teaching length of the session. But then the second person who's learned Chinese from a teacher, maybe now he's going to be teaching for 6 months and a day. And then the next one, 6 months and 2 days. You understand? You will slightly increase the teaching time. And then we show that if you do that the right way, then it's sustainable. In other words, Chinese will be taught very faithfully forever. The number of learners could be infinite. There will never be more than epsilon loss. By just increasing the length, just ever so slightly, so you can formalize this, you can talk about epsilon delta sustainability, and the intuition is pretty clear for any learners, it could be an infinite number of them, with very high probability, the variation between Chinese and the language that you will draw from your own distribution, your posterior distribution, will differ very, very little, okay? So that's what it means, and we show that if you increase the length, not to be 6 months fixed forever, but to be something logarithmic in t. T is the time, is the number of steps. The teeth learner, rather. Then this is sustainable forever. Okay. Now, Kalish, Griffiths, and Lewandowski have pursued this work, and they've performed experiments on human beings, well, I mean, they are students, I'm not sure that qualifies, but you know, in psychology, you always experiment on undergraduate students. These are the only considered living, you know, human species. And so they tried to teach Berkeley students about a line going down. How do you teach them about a line going down? So you do this by sampling. So you don't give them a line, you show them a cloud of points that really look like a line going down. You could even infer it's probably y equals minus x plus 1 or something like that. But it doesn't matter. You just want to teach them a line going down. And so you do the same thing we just did with the owl and all of that. And here's what you get. You get this, you get this, you get this, you get this. And then you get this. You can never teach them a line going down. It will always go to a line going up. And now this could be maybe just in the US, maybe in some more pessimistic countries it's the opposite. And this is not just a frivolous comment, it's not only a frivolous comment, because the US has this particular feature, not shared in many other countries, where it does not have any sign around airports of planes going down. None. In Russia there are plenty such signs, you can see them through Google. But in the US, somehow psychologically, when you run an airport, you never want to have a public sign that points to the wrong direction, for obvious reasons. So all the planes go up. These are airports where you can only take off, you can never land. And so I don't know if there's any connection, who knows? So anyway, some people want to understand what's going on, and that's not me, because I'm not a psycholinguist, and I'm only half of that. Final thing is regression. Yeah, so this point's going down. So this is a problem of regression. I mean, I'm trying to teach you regression in iterated fashion. I give you the cloud of points going down. I want you to regress this into a line, obviously, and blah, 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 blah. So we can do this in higher dimensions. Show that if you have a prior of a certain idea of what a hyperplane ought to be, you know, points drawn from this with noise, and then there's a teacher that has a different idea about what that hyperplane ought to be, and the likelihood is just sampling from your candidate hyperplane with noise, So you have this line going down, you can teach it, and then we show that if you increase the length of the session, again, this will make the process sustainable forever, so you will faithfully teach your whatever hyperplane you have in mind. Okay, now here's the whole point, is that this goes against the grain of most probabilistic reasoning in computer science, because it's thinking out of equilibrium, something physicists do sometimes do, and biologists do more often, and computer science almost never do. And so let me explain. So this is the angle that I want to talk about. So when you have a Markov chain, which is a Sturm equilibrium, it always reaches stationary distribution, or minus some technicality of no importance. Which means that after a while, the whole system runs without energy from the outside, and you can no longer tell the direction of time. You can no longer tell whether it's going one way or the other. Now, if you want to have sustainability for iterated learning, you remember these people, Griffiths and Kalish and so on, observed that this was Gibbs sampling. So this was a Markov chain. And a Markov chain will always lead to this sort of thermal death. And so to avoid that, then you have to inject energy into the system. Okay, so in other words, it's exactly the opposite of 50 years of research in computer science that asked the question, given a Markov chain, please show me that it mixes very fast. Here we want the opposite. We want, here's a Markov chain, what's the minimum amount of work I have to do to keep it from ever mixing? Okay, which I would argue is probably the single most important problem in biology, but maybe if we have time we can get back to this. So this notion of natural algorithm, which I've been working on for a long time, just to remind you, a classical algorithm looks like this, a natural algorithm looks like this, so pretty much they look the same. So it's just, a natural algorithm is just a classical algorithm, but we didn't get to engineer it, nature did, or whatever your philosophy of metaphysics is, that thing did it. And again, from a physics point of view, I mean, I spent 2 years speaking mostly to physicists, and so maybe I'm a little bit conditioned now, but it matters really to understand actually how the physics works, is that a natural algorithm, or for that matter, any living organism, any living system, exchanges matter and energy with the outside, but it does it in a very particular way. It always will require free energy, so that's energy that you can absorb into work and perform work, and this what will happen. And in doing so, it will produce entropy, okay? In fact, some people have argued that living organisms, that evolution is really the art of maximizing the production of your entropy. And in particular, this is achieved through irreversibility, which right there tells you exactly why Markov chain is exactly the wrong model. The first irreversible process in life is reproduction, which is obviously irreversible. But most of the evolutionary innovations that can be best explained from a physics point of view, a biophysics point of view, in terms of irreversibility. Now, from a computer scientist, this is very interesting because this is really a different way of thinking. And so I want to explore this. Now, if you look at this as a hood and you just lift the hood and see what's inside, then often what you see is a graph, but a graph that's dynamic. It changes all the time. And it often changes in endogenous ways. It has its own rhythm, its own dynamic. And the graph, which tells you what communicates with what, changes. Now, again, it exchanges, it receives information from the outside. So it could be matter or free energy, but it could be just signals, driving fields, or something that drives something, carbon sources, environmental fluctuations. All of this that makes evolution possible is a requirement. And so I worked on this very simple model, but it's not that simple. It's very simple to explain what it is, but not so simple to analyze, called influence systems. And this is the full description. So here's what happens. So you have these nodes, they're called agents, and They're just a name. But the reason they're called agents is because they behave like agents. You see, first of all, each one has its own state. So if this was a cell, so for example, the state could be where it is currently in the cell cycle, or its growth, its whatever. You want that all the parameters that matters to describe that object. So they all have this, and then they interact with each other, and so each agent picks its in edges. In edges means the other agents that will provide information to that agent. So by decide, I mean that there is a process, there's an algorithm, like the cell will get its receptors to get proteins through it, or signals, transduction, and all that will be determined by the environment, of course, by what's outside, but by the particular algorithm that the cell happens to have and which has evolved. And all these rules from the agents for the type. So of course, once you have this information, you update your new state and you go like this forever. But here's the point. Each agent could be different. These do not have to have the same rules. I mean, this is very important in biology, in particular, that diversity is really part of what makes things interesting. They're just not all the same. So it's such a broad, general model. You can almost do model anything you want with this. So a flock of birds and fish. This is a colony of bacteria, or this is just what happens inside the cell. And I can model all this if you want. But before I go into this, I just want to have a quick digression on why theory. I'm sorry, how long is this talk? At least like 50 minutes? 50, okay. All right, thank you. Why theory? Everybody works on big data. Theory is gone. Mathematics is gone. We just have to look at numbers and they tell us what to do. They will just rule our lives. I think I'm wasting your time and my time. But here's why I don't believe this for a second. And I mean, there are millions of reasons why this is an absurd proposition, but here's a good one. I mean, suppose you are a Martian and you come planet Earth to find out what it's all about, and then you see this. This is the RSA chip that many people have just to get into a building or into your computer or something like that. And now this is very much like a living organism, except it doesn't live very much, but it's a circuit. It's got all this thing going on. Now suppose you're the Martian and you have supercomputers and all that, and you want to find out what it does. Okay, so you can put electrodes and just start measuring currents and do whatever you do. Just think of a neuroscientist. Whatever a neuroscientist can do with your brain, you can do even more with that, because this cannot die, because it's not alive. So that's the advantage of not being alive. You can never die. And so you can play with this. Here's the point. The Martian will never figure out what it does, I claim, until it learns some basic number theory. Just think about it, okay? And this will not teach number theory. QED, all right? And so without some theory, you can look at this until you're blue in the face. You will never figure out, unless you know Fermat's little theorem, for example, you'll never understand what this does, except just tracking bits. But that was just a digression. I want to go back to the... So if you're going to do some theory, then you have to have some tools, and I've been working mostly on this, on finding conceptual tools, not so much on answering question, what's the meaning of life, why we're here, I don't know, but tools like divide and conquer and plane sweep that Franco was mentioning. Are there some paradigms that are kind of useful, will be useful in the future perhaps, or something like that? So one of them is semantic renormalization. I want to talk about quickly. Renormalization is a very common term in physics, but every field uses a variant of that concept. So you can call it dimension reduction, coarse graining. If you're a computer scientist, probably if you're a programming language person, abstractions, what you call it. If you're otherwise a graph algorithms person, it's just hierarchical graph clustering. I mean, you can do all this. So don't fixate on the term renormalization, but semantic is important. So let me explain what I mean by this. Now, there's been a lot of work on, here's a graph. So the graph could be embedded in some space or not. But often it is embedded in some space, and you want to cluster it. You want to find the communities of a Google search or on the internet or something like that, on the web, or whatever you want to do. But there's a large network, and you want to cut it up into pieces that make sense. And there are a gazillion ways of doing that, depending on your application. If it's computer graphics, if it's biology, there's lots of ways of doing that. And they all have to do with some kind of distance measure that you define and that makes you happy. And that's syntactical clustering. That's not semantic clustering. Okay, so here's what I mean by semantic clustering. Now, here's a graph. You don't get to see the graph because I didn't draw the edges. But if you are a player, a soccer player, and these are professionals, they actually know when they're on the field at any time who they're supposed to look at. They don't have to look at the entire thing. They can, you know, so you can imagine this directed graph that connects the players to what they're doing. Okay. Now, given that graph, you can go find your clustering experts down the hall of your department and say, okay, how do you cluster it? And they'll give you all these fancy techniques. Oh, you should do a spectral clustering. That's the way to do it, and so on and so forth. And then you go see a six-year-old kid, you know, at recess in a school, and you ask him, how do you do it? And he'll do it the right way. And because there's only one way you can cluster this, it's like this. It's completely obvious. Has nothing to do with geometry. And by the way, has nothing to do with the fact that the jerseys are red or white. They could all, you know, have the same jerseys, same shirts. The six-year-old kid will still know this is the only way you should cluster this graph before the game starts. There are two teams. It's obvious. But the geometry might not tell you that. This is not the obvious way of separating these sets. Maybe here would be a much more natural thing. Why is it that, well, because the kid knows about soccer. And if you just understand the game, even just a little bit, then you know exactly how this graph falls into clusters. And when you think about it, it's entirely semantic. It's totally based on the rules. Now, the geometry plays a role, don't get me wrong, but the geometry is totally filtered through the process, a semantic process of understanding, why do we have this graph to begin with? Why am I looking at people? The players know that instinctively. The coach will do renormalization, you know, clustering on a constant basis. But the graph, I try not to destroy this institution, and the graph changes all the time. That's the whole point. Okay, for example, when you're here, well, if you're a soccer, you know that you've got to mark the opponents, but not just any opponents, and so on. So again, the coach and the players and the fans, they pretty much know. In fact, the commentaries and newspaper the next day will say, well, this team lost because, well, they won't put it that way, but because their renormalization was wrong. You know, the guy was marking the wrong, you know, he should have been on this player, not that player, and so on and so forth. So, first of all, and this clustering is not path independent. So it's not even the case that give me the graph, I'll cluster it. No. It's very important to know the path. Why? Because you cannot change the clustering too fast. A player is not every 2 seconds completely change his understanding of the game. The clustering will have some consistency and will evolve more or less smoothly at the time scale of the player's thinking. Okay, and so, but on the other hand, any six-year-old kid said that's the only way to do it. The spectral clustering is completely irrelevant, okay, when you look at this. And these graphs is what happens in biology. It's different from, say, the stars or, you know, things like that, which tend not to move too much. So now, again, let's look at some examples where we might apply this sort of semantic clustering. So here's a Markov chain. Look at the physical system that's a closed system, which isn't what we don't want. So a closed system will become a Markov chain. Because if a system is closed, then the second law of thermodynamics kicks in. It's a Markov chain, and the whole thing mixes. So now, if you want to understand the dynamics, so you want to do dynamical system on that, then dynamics means to classify the orbits. I mean, that's the meaning of the entire field. Okay. Turns out to be very easy. You can just get any textbook on Markov chains and tell you exactly what to do. You have this graph, and it'll tell you that this is the way you cluster the graph. I mean, even if you don't know anything about Markov chain, it doesn't matter. There's only one way of clustering a Markov chain like this, I just drew it. End of theory. There's nothing else to say. But it's semantically driven. It has nothing to do with the particular geometry of the graph. Okay, it has to do with the dynamics of the Markov chain. Now, this is very boring. Okay, so renormalization involves coarse graining, which means once you've done something like this, mentally, you have to think that now this has become a super agent. So these three agents really now form a super agent of three. So now you have five super agents of two kinds. In Markov chain classifications, these clusters have different meaning, okay? And so they're treated differently. So one is yellow and one is green, blue. I don't know, some color close to that spectrum. And so, but the hierarchy is all flat, okay? Because that's it. This is an entire renormalization. There's nothing else to do. Now, in open systems, those we're interested in natural algorithms or open systems, then it's a whole different thing. Now, what you have is dynamics of dynamic networks. Now, dynamic networks have been studied for 30 years, 40 years. I mean, the field of algorithms is full of work on dynamic networks. The dynamics of network is a very popular subject, all the scale-free graphs, power law, blah, blah, all of that. The small world phenomena. This is all about the dynamics of networks. But there's very little work on dynamics of dynamic networks, which is unfortunate because this is really what every living form shows. So what matters is really to have some kind of conceptual tool to track the flow of information across a network when the network changes all the time. Okay, think about it. It's you're doing a random walk on this network of roads, but then the roads break down, or maybe new roads are created while you're doing it. And the creation of the roads is due to your own walking, okay? Because this is what happens when there's too much traffic on a road, then the road breaks down. And because there's too much traffic on the road, people build other roads. So there's this feedback loop, and this is what you need to understand. Now, these things give rise to deep renormalization hierarchy. So again, without going into any details, I'll just tell you what, just a little cartoon to explain what I have in mind. So think of an infinite sequence of graphs, okay? And they all have the same number of nodes. So you have a fixed number of agents, and then you have an infinite number of graphs. Typically, these graphs are embedded in some space, but they don't even have to, but typically they are. And you want to understand what, and information flows. Just think of these agents as passing messages to the neighbors constantly. And well, let's just pick one, small example. Suppose that this agent knows a tune, knows the Italian anthem, okay? And nobody else knows it. Now, this guy's gonna be singing the Italian anthem, and those that point to him will get to hear it. So they will learn the anthem, okay? And so on and so forth. Now, the question is, will everybody learn the Italian anthem at some point? Now, if the graph was fixed, well, this is like algorithms 101, okay? It just depends, whether the graph is strongly connected or not, or not, if not strongly connected. I mean, you've seen all this, there should be a path, or maybe. But when the graph changes all the time, there's no such thing. There's strongly connected means nothing, actually. There's no such notion. And yet, this is a well-defined concept. I want to know if within 6 months, magic 6 months, everybody will know the Italian anthem, yes or no? In biology, these are the kind of systems that arise all the time. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to interpret this entire thing as a sentence in a formal language. So in this language, the letters, the alphabet, if you will, consist of letters, and each letter will be a graph. Okay, so there's a finite number of them, because there's a finite number of graphs. And so these are the letters. And then I'll give you a grammar, and the grammar will allow you to form these sentences that are valid sentences. And given that, then we'll be able to parse it. Okay, we'll be able to parse it the way you parse a programming language, you know, program or something like that. And from this, we will build the renormalization, so it will respect time. So over time, you can read this thing. And as you go up, you get to see the coarse graining of these. It's not that easy to visualize, actually, because hierarchical clustering, you know, you use three dimensions to usually think about it. You know, you think of a sort of, you start with these blobs, and the blobs get, you know, and so on. But now think of this as moving over time. So the blobs get rearranged, and the parsing takes place like this. Now, why are we doing this? Because this is extremely useful, okay? So, you know, then you can show that, say, under some conditions, almost all orbits have limit cycles. So essentially, the system is almost always periodic, and which kind of matters. Now, you can also show some other things that are very critical, in my view, to biology, which is mixed time scales and archival mechanism. I think one of the most intriguing aspects of biology is the emergence of memory. Now, the time ratios are absolutely staggering. I mean, you know, look at your own body and look at the smallest cycle you have and the biggest cycle you have. The time scales are just off by absolutely, you know, by gazillions. This is really astonishing. How does this work? I mean, how does your body knows that you have to have, you know, even circadian cycle? I mean, we understand the proteins involved in circadian cycle. We do all this. Do we understand why this actually works? No, we don't. Absolutely not a clue. And to me, these are really very important questions. And maybe a little time I have left, I'll look back at some of the work that I did. I got started in natural algorithms by birds, and so I've always had a certain affinity for flocks of birds. And then I gave up because I thought it was way too difficult, so I'd do something easier. But what I learned from the work on birds, so there's certain flocking model where these birds are flying happy and each bird looks within a radius of R, and then they average their velocity. So they're all flying at some velocity, and this guy will just look at these friends and just take the average velocity and continue flying and just do that. And so what you can show is that where the birds will fly and it'll be a big mass, but after a while they'll start merging into flocks, I guess. And then finally, the flocks will reach steady state, and that'll be the end, okay? Now, this is interesting because you can show that the worst-case convergence time is a tire of two of height log the number of birds. This is a very strange function. It's not very common. But this is optimal, actually. This system, the Smale-Vishek model, actually, this is the function. It's like the busy beaver function of that computer. Now, of course, no living system has this function doing anything. This is obvious. But that's not the right question. The right question is, why do we get these big time scales? What happens? How come this system, which you can model as a natural algorithm, so the way I've talked about, how come it produces these? You see, like, Markov chains have only two time scales, polynomial, exponential, and that's it. There's nothing else, okay? To some extent, they have no time, okay? There's no time quantity you can extract for a Markov chain, basically. But natural algorithms, when you have these open systems, now you can start really having all these different time scales that interact. And which is, by the way, what really distinguishes biology from physics and chemistry, in my view, the most, are time scales, okay? Biology is really the part of physics where time scales are inseparable. You know, in any other kind of physics, pretty much the first thing you do is separate time scales so you can simply work on one particular branch. And you cannot do that in biology. And so we need tools for that. Let me just skip all this. So, but at least you see some nice geometry. I hope you appreciate it. Yeah, just tell you how long it took me to draw that picture. So I decided to work on something easier, and there are these German social scientists who had introduced the system named after them, And it's a very neat system. I thought this is like flocking, but easier, so maybe you should do something there. So everybody is somewhere on the political spectrum. So here in two dimensions, you're right-wing, left-wing, libertarian, authoritarian, you're somewhere. And then you speak and you listen to, maybe to listen to everybody, but you're only influenced by people who are kind of like you, okay? So you can listen to a crazy guy all day, has no influence on your opinion. But if you listen to a good friend, and there's some differences of opinion, then you pay attention, and maybe you adjust your opinion a little bit. So all these agents have a certain circle of influence, and they listen to their friends over here, and then they maybe move to the center of gravity, or some weighted center, mass center of their neighbors, and they all do that. And so you draw a pretty picture. You see there's nice symmetry breaking. You start with a Poisson process. It's a uniform distribution, and then you have these little two-dimensional structure that appears, and so on. It's almost like Voronoi diagrams. And now, so you can formalize this in one dimension. It's, you just have given an agent I, the neighbors are defined by all the agents J at distance R, so this is on the line. And then everybody moves to the average of their neighbors. So this guy I will move to the average of itself and this one and this one. And that's it, they all do that forever. So this is known to converge, and we have bounds on this. And so this is fairly well understood. But there was I worked with a student on a famous conjecture that said that when you start from a random initial configuration, so here this is random, so between say 0 and 10, then you spread tons of agents over here, okay? And then this is time, and you have these dynamics. And what happens is they all cluster into these things, and there's a separation roughly 2R, and the 2R conjecture states that with high probability or on average or what have you, the separation will be 2R, okay? And there'll be lots of simulation. It's a very strange conjecture because, well, first of all, it's obviously false, because when you actually run the simulation, you find it's 2.3R. But on the other hand, I mean, of course they knew that, but they figure, you know, 2.3 is very close to 2, and 2 is a nicer number than 2.3. So maybe it's okay to call your conjecture 2R, when in fact it's 2.3R. And but the worst is nobody knew how to prove this thing, and we still don't know how to prove it. So, well, you can quickly realize that one of the problems are the pathologies. When the agents really, you know, even though it's random, random could mean strange things. They could start in a very close to sort of critical configuration. So you don't like this, and so you do something that's very common in physics, which means you introduce a little bit of random Brownian motion. Okay, so you can set up a stochastic differential equation where the agents do their averaging over here, but then there's a little Brownian process that goes with the noise sigma, and then you can draw these phase diagrams between the noise and R, which is the length of this averaging. You know, you're looking R on both sides, and you average yourself, and you see a phase transition, which is interesting, between order, between sort of something what you would have clustering, and when you increase sigma, the noise, then you have something that becomes flat, which is a uniform. So the diffusion wins. So it's a battle between diffusion, which is, you know, sort of dissipative process, and then there's this contracting, you know, there's a contractive process. We try to average. Averaging process is something that will, you know, contract. It will, all the eigenvalues are strictly less than one. So here's what we did. We actually looked at the thermodynamic limit, which is when you take the number of agents and you bring n to infinity, which to some extent is what we do asymptotic analysis of algorithms. And so we end up with an equation that's a variant of very well-studied family of equations in physics called Fokker-Planck. And we use a formulation by these three people who studied also the similar dynamics. And so, okay, we showed that actually this was well-posed, which interestingly was not known. And well-posed means that the differential equation has a solution. It's unique, and it's a good solution. It's smooth, regular, it's all kinds of nice things. And then we proved that there's a number, 2.29. It's not the exact number, but it's a transcendental number, but it's close to 2.3. So very close to 2.3. And so to do this, it's more like standard, or I don't know if it's standard, but differential equations. You do a separation of variables between the modes of, so you basically take these Fourier modes and you try to look at the right k, the k that will determine the cluster. The separation between clusters would correspond to a given mode, and you're sort of looking for that. And so you end up with an expression like this, and you say gamma equals zero, and then you take the derivative of that thing, and the point at which the zero gives you s, and s is related to that mode k, so that gives you the mode k, and then it gives you the intercluster distance 2 pi r over s, and that's how we get this. But it just goes to show how much easier differential equations are than the real. I mean, discrete is infinitely more difficult. Okay, I mean, everything you can do in differential equations, you can do with discrete. The other way around is absolutely not true. And so, to some extent, I mean, it's not that surprising. We could solve the 2R conjecture, the 2.3R conjecture, in the thermodynamic limit, but we still have not any clue how to do it in the discrete case when you have n objects. Okay, let's see. I have like 2 minutes left or something like this. Yeah, 5 minutes. Okay, so you know, I just put lots of slides in here, and maybe I'll just skip that because you're all very tired. It's been a long day. No, it hasn't been a long day. It's a nice thing to say. It's been a very long day, and well, for me, because I just flew in. I'm a little bit jet lagged. Maybe you've noticed. Okay, yeah. Let me just actually. Okay. I don't know how much what I said made much sense to you, but I want to make a larger point, which I think is, I think the field of natural algorithms raises all kinds of philosophical questions, and the first one is from a computer scientist's point of view, is what role do computer scientists, is there any particular angle, I'm not even saying results, is there any results computer science has that could be brought to bear? The answer is no, so forget about that. That's the wrong question. The right question is, fields bring their own culture and perspective, a particular perspective. There's a certain perspective way of looking at things. And is there anything particular about the perspective of computer science, in particular of algorithms, that could be of use in biology, which is really ultimately what I'm interested in? And my hope is yes. Okay, this is unprovable, obviously. But my hope is yes, and maybe this thing tries to illustrate what's going on. Why is biology so difficult? And well, there's a standard answers. Well, there's history. It's the only truly historical science in the natural sciences, because evolution sort of records all these past events, which the rest of physics doesn't. Literally doesn't. Okay, you want to study the planets, just look at them right now. You know, each planet has momentum and position, pretty much all you need to know. Equations will do the rest. This is remarkable. You don't have to know the past of the solar system. It's irrelevant. That's not true in biology. And so we don't know how much we should know or not know. You know, all these variables, which one are important, you know, which one are not. But I think that why is it physics was able to do that? I mean, after all, even mechanics, you know, involves trillions and trillions of small bodies interacting, you know, your molecules, the atoms, and so on. So it's very complicated. You cannot solve Schrödinger's equation every time you you drop a ball to see how fast it goes. There are macroscopic laws that somehow bypass all this. So there must be some cancellation. There must be some simplifications. All these Avogadro number of tiny objects doing their own thing obviously must be coming to some kind of consensus so that we can observe this and make sense of it without having to look down at each of the molecules in position and where they are. So this is the miracle of universality. You see this in the law of large numbers, maybe that's the best example. You know, if you add an immensely large collection of variables, random variables that are independent or mostly independent, then it doesn't matter what they are, as long as you know their means and their standard deviation, that's it. There's a law that says, I know what will happen to the sum. In fact, the bigger the better. So is the n body problem in reverse. The bigger n is, the more accurate your estimate will be. So this is universality. It means that at the level of the observable, the particular details don't matter. I mean, this is like things like the icing model have been so successful. It's because they're independent of the particular lattice arrangement in which you perform your calculations, because we know these are not what nature does, actually, but the principle says it doesn't matter. At the very low dimensional level, so this would be like some part of algorithms, but also, you know, calculus used in dynamical systems. Dynamical systems theory is a beautiful field, and there's one historical weakness, which is not due to anybody, it's just the course of history, which is that the problem originated from the solar system, from studying the planets. And here's the thing, there are not many planets, there are very few planets. And in dynamical systems, virtually all the interesting phenomena occur in low dimensions. You don't have to go to very high dimensions to start seeing remarkable things. In very, very low dimension, much less than 10, everything that's worth knowing, I mean, it's not quite right. I mean, but that's the way the focus of the field has been. Biology is not like that. Biology falls in the middle. It's not big enough that you can use the laws of universality that you find in equilibrium, statistical mechanics, for example, very, very powerful. On the other hand, it's too big. It's too big, you know, so like flocks could be 10,000 birds. It's too big and too small. These numbers are exactly the worst numbers. And somehow, I think that's really what we're trying to come to terms with, which is when you have small numbers, but not too small, and you have diversity, then somehow our standard analytical tools, you know, seem to break down. And so in that sense, to some extent, I think that given the role of time, the role of time plays in these systems, which they do not, say for Markov chains, then I think this is what computer science is called, the field of algorithms is called upon to play a big role, because algorithms is equations plus memory. Okay, I mean, what distinguishes algorithms from the rest of mathematics is the role of time, but not just time, but memory. Okay, that's what makes algorithms powerful. And biology, the real miracle of biology, I believe, is the role of time and memory, that sort of innovation, the constant innovation through evolution. So I will, I think, stop here. Hopefully I'm not too much. Thank you.